Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Tasyam prapidyamanayam abhimani puranjanah janah avaporuvidham sthapan kutumbhi mamata kulah. Tasyam prapidyamanayam abhimani puranjanah avaporuvidham sthapan kutumbhi mamata kulah. Tasyam prapidyamanayam abhimani puranjanah avaporuvidham sthapan kuntumbi mamata kulah. Mothers. Tasyam prapidyamanayam abhimani puranjanah avaporuvidham sthapan mata kulah. Tasyam prapidyamanayam abhimani puranjanah avaporuvidham sthapan mata kulah. Tasyam prapidyamanayam abhimani puranjanah avaporuvidham sthapan kuntumbhi mamata kulah. Tasyam, when the city prapidyamanayam was put into different difficulties, abhimani, too much absorbed, puranjanah, King Puranjana, avapa, achieved, Uru many vidhan varieties tapan paints kutumbi family man amata akula too much affected by attachment to family. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation. When the city was thus endangered by the soldiers, and Kalakanya, King Puranjana, being overly absorbed in affection for his family, was placed in difficulty by the attack of Yavanaraj and Kalakanya. Purport. When we refer to the body, we include the external gross body with its various limbs, as well as the mind, intelligence, and ego. In old age, these all become weak when they are attacked by different diseases. The proprietor of the body, the living soul, becomes very sad at not being able to use the field of activities properly. In Bhagavad Gita, it is clearly explained that the living entity is a proprietor of his body, Chaitra Gya, and that the body is the field of activities, Chaitra. When a field is overgrown with thorns and weeds, it becomes very difficult for the owner to work it. That is the position of the spirit soul when the body itself becomes a burden due to disease. Extra burdens are placed on the body in the form of anxiety and general deterioration of the bodily functions. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Om Agyanta Mirandasha Giranjana Shalakaya Chakshunumiditam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitana Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupakadama Yam Dadati Swapadantikam Vanchakabhutarubhyascha Kripasandubhyarivachapati Tadam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. I'll just read the translation again because I kind of botched it up. Translation, when the city was thus endangered by the soldiers and Kalakanya, King Puranjana, being overly absorbed in affection for his family, was placed in difficulty by the attack of Yavanaraj and Kalakanya. Hare Krishna. And Srila Prabhupada is giving the analogy from chapter 13 of Bhagavad Gita of the Chaitra and the Chaitra Gya, the knower of the field, and the field of activities. So the field of activities refers to the body in the context of Bhagavad Gita. But the idea of this analogy is that the field of activities is the source of happiness. And it begins with the bodily concept of life. So in the field of activities, which is the source of happiness, then the Chaitra Gya, the knower of the field, plants many seeds. The many seeds of desires in that field of activity, which is the source of happiness. And then, of course, those seeds of desire, although planted and cultivated very nicely by the Chaitra Gya, the knower of the field, on his own strength, he's not able to manifest the fruits of those seeds. It has to rain. Otherwise, the seeds don't sprout. So in the same way, without the authority of the Lord, then those seeds of desire never come to pass. The Lord, in this context, means the Paramatma, who knows the karmic reactions of the jiva. So according to his desire and his deserve, then Paramatma will give accordingly reciprocation. And then some of those seeds will begin to fructify, and the field of activity is a source of happiness. So that's the idea of the analogy. It's very, sagacious, very nice analogy of Krishna. The idea of the source of happiness, the field of activities, it begins with the material body, but that concept expands to the whole material existence. It begins with, I think I'm this body, that's the original source of happiness, but it begins to expand to other things which we also will consider the source of happiness, the field of activities. So for example, for a student, his field of activities is, let's say, school. And he sees school as the source of happiness. And so then he invests all his desires into school, thinking that I'll get a very nice education, and from there everything will start to work out very nice. I'll get a job, and I'll be able to make nice money. And when I get good money, I'll be able to get women, etc. So that school becomes his field of activities, right? And then within the school, he has his particular field, right? Material science or whatever, art, mechanics, like this. It expands. Let's say for parents, their material field begins with the body, but it extends to their children. So their children become something like a field of activity. So they invest desires into the children in order to fulfill their own desires. It's like sometimes parents, let's say, I'm just giving an example, they maybe weren't good enough to live out their dreams to be a sports star. So when they have their kids, then they want to train their kids up as, you know, soccer players and baseball players with the hope that I'll be able to live out my desire for fame and prestige through my kids. I think that was true with like, what was his name? I don't remember his name. The Williams sisters' father. He couldn't be himself a tennis player. So from birth, he just trained his kids up how to be really good tennis players. And that way, his kids become the source of his happiness. I'm not going to name the movie I'm thinking of because I see devotees sometimes go check out these things on YouTube, so we have to be careful what we say. That happened to me. I was mentioning an analogy in Bhagavad Gita class, and one devotee went and looked it up on YouTube, so I said, I better be careful. But in one of the movies that I used to like, it's a ballet movie, so don't go Google search engine. It was a ballet movie of, and in the movie, there was one girl who was a very, very good dancer. She was starving herself and all these things to be a good dancer. But she didn't want to be a dancer. It was her mother's desire. So her mother was putting all types of pressure on her. She had her trained from youth, and she wouldn't allow her to do anything. Finally, at the end of the movie, she breaks out of her mother's field of activity and gets her own field of activity of sense gratification because she didn't want to be a dancer. So in that way, although it appears that persons are, in context of what I'm saying, selfless, actually, in the material world, for all created beings, it is their own self that is most dear. This is a statement of Shukadeva Goswami in the Bhagavatam. No one is more dear to us in this material world than our own selves in conditioned life. That's reality. And although, let me say, that seems counterintuitive because, well, what about parents and their kids? They sacrifice all energy for their kids, right? Or a patriot. He's sometimes a patriot will even give up his life for his country. So how can you say that it is the self that is most dear? Because they'll even give up their own lives for their children or their country. So then the Bhagavatam explains, yeah, that appears to be so, that they're doing it in a selfless way. But actually, they've expanded their egos into those things. So if the patriot didn't think of himself as a patriot of a great country, would he make the same sacrifice for his country? Just like devotees, we don't consider ourselves patriots, right? Like we hear, okay, let's go and vote, let's go and fight for the country. We don't get into those things. Why? Because we don't consider ourselves as patriots, you know, and we consider ourselves as servants of Krishna. So therefore, doing that activity doesn't match the conception of ourselves that we're having, which is a proper conception, the conception of service to Krishna. But if we thought of ourselves as a patriot, then going and sacrificing my life for my country gratifies that egoistic conception. So it's not at all selfless, because if I didn't have that conception, I wouldn't go for that sacrifice. So in the same way for parents, the parents will expand their egos into their children. So it looks like a selfless affair when the mother is sacrificing her life for the kid or something like that. But in fact, it is her own self that is most dear, and that sacrifice gratifies that egoistic conception, and therefore she appears to be selfless. So that can be discouraging, because we all thought, well, what about love? That example is always given about the closest thing to love in the material world, right, is the love of a mother for a child. But it turns out that is also just a selfish affair. The idea is that if you look at it superficially, it most closely resembles something like pure love. But actually, it's all a selfish affair. So this is going on. We're expanding our false ego into the whole material existence. So the whole material world, beginning with our false ego, becomes our field of enjoyment. That's also being mentioned here by Mamata Akula. Well, Mamata means mine. Mine is based on the conception of I. And the more we get absorbed in the mind, then the more the conception of I becomes reinforced. And that way we're shackled down into the material existence. So this is the analogy that Krishna is giving of the Chaitra and the Chaitragya. It's a very nice analogy. So having invested so many desires into the field of activity, we are hoping that the fruit of that investment is going to rise up in the form of a nice fruit tree, an apple tree, or a mango tree, or a CEO tree, or the artist tree, or the famous rock star tree. The what else is very popular today? Astronaut tree. No. Well, these are the various trees that we want to sprout up. We're making our various desires. Of course, every field has certain trees. The trees of wife, home, children, and the rest. As Krishna describes in Gita, all the fields will be having these particular trees in them. And then a variety of other types of trees. So we're hoping that these various seeds will give rise to the tree, and that way we can taste the fruits of our various desires. And as I already mentioned, we can't do it on our own strength. You need rain to come down. So ultimately, the authority of God is required for these various karmas to fructify. So now what Srila Prabhupada is mentioning here in the purport is that when the field of activity becomes attacked, then the Chaitragya, the person who's identifying with the field, becomes very sad. Prabhupada is saying that here. The proprietor of the body, the field of activities, the living soul becomes very sad at not being able to use the field of activities properly. So suppose in each field, there are unlimited seeds. Because we're in the modes of passion and ignorance, so we keep generating more and more and more and more desires following the general populace. Kamam, bikamam, anuya, prapatam, prasangat. Prahlad Maharaj explains, following the general populace, I've been victimized by desire after desire after desire due to my bad association. So then each field has unlimited desires, and only some of the seeds are giving rise to these various trees and the various fruits according to our karma. But somehow or other, that never satisfies us. It's like, suppose you planted a mango tree and a mango seed, a grape seed, an apple seed, but only the apple seed sprouted up. Now, that's success. Actually, it's a success, isn't it? I mean, especially because most of us don't know how to plant anything. So if that were to happen, we'd be totally ecstatic. I would be totally ecstatic. Like, side tangential point, when we were in elementary school, they used to give us these science projects to like take care of snails and all these things. You all remember that? And I always used to kill them because we didn't know how to take care properly, you know. We would try to feed it everything. I guess we overfed it. Sometimes we underfed it. Sometimes we would forget, and so you would just kill it. In other words, we don't know how to take care of other living entities properly. So if we were able to actually give rise to an apple tree, that would be success, ecstatic. But that's not satisfying because we planted also a mango tree and a grape tree. And so we can't be satisfied with the fact that only an apple tree has come up. We want all the other trees to also come up. So imagine this field of activity, we have unlimited desires. And according to our karma, only some of the seeds are producing trees and fruits. So the living entity is always dissatisfied because what about all those other seeds I planted? All those other seeds are there. I want those to also come up. So he's hoping against hope. This is called Dharashaya Ye, Bahir Arthamanina. Bahir Arthamanina means externally absorbed. And Dharashaya means hoping against hope that these other seeds will soon come up. And this hope lasts, I guess, until the end of the life. As I was mentioning in the other class, this business magnate, he's worth $5 billion, 94 years old, and he's getting married to his fifth wife. 94 years old. Isn't that unbelievable? That's not even unbelievable. This is not even the unbelievable part. The more unbelievable part is that he's saying, I just want to have 5 or 6 more kids. That's what he said to the news reporter. That's not even the unbelievable part. His wife said, she started laughing and said, I'm not so young. I said, neither is he. How will you do it? So anyway, the point I'm making is that these desires to be fulfilled last until the end of one's life. Even though the obvious truth is that this is not a possibility. Pashyanapi napashyati, seeing This word Pashanapinapashati means seeing but not seeing. That means seeing but not examining. We see birth, death, disease, and old age surrounding us, but we never examine it. Just like sometimes when we're driving in the city, and we see like an old lady crossing the street. So sometimes you're wondering, why is it taking so long at this stop sign? And then you look outside the window and there's this old lady crossing. It's taking her like 15 minutes to cross the street. And everyone's just getting frustrated. My sin's gratification is pending. Yeah, that is, they get frustrated. But no one even stops to examine what is actually taking place. This is a huge opportunity for profound realization. Just like we used to go to this old age home just down the street on Tui. And all these old people would, you know, be there riding bodies. When you walked into the place, the smell would knock you out. One time we took Prahlad and Simon with us. And when he was there, he was just like this the whole time. And we said, Prahlad and Simon, chant. Hare Krishna. And he was so despondent singing. Of course, nice thing about kids is that they show what we feel internally. That is the nice thing about internally, we're also thinking the same. It's not that we were so transcendental that, no, we're just about compassion. We were also, many of the devotees would comment when we would walk into the place. We would choke by the smell. It was so horrible. And then we would be so absorbed in the horrible smell and the rotting bodies that oftentimes we never stop to examine what is taking place. This is a huge opportunity for realization. I with the young boys, when I took Mukunda came with us one time, and I used to always tell the man about this meditation. I said, when you go into the old age home, imagine that they were exactly like you. They liked the same video games. They liked the same TV shows. They went to the same school, got the same degree, had a nice family, a nice job, and all these things, and now look at them. Look at their situation. So I said, just do that as a meditation when you go to this place. So then he went inside the place, and when he came out, he was like, that was too intense. You know, it's very intense of you. Because if one were to meditate like that, then he gains a spiritual perception, as we were mentioning before, that can protect us from being victims of illusion. If we can see how everything is being devoured by the snake of time, just like if you see a house is being devoured by fire, you're not going to enter inside the house. Most likely. In the same way, if you can see the material world is being devoured by the snake of time, then you're not going to try to enjoy it. So therefore, Pingala says, you become qualified to be the protector of your own soul. So anyway, this is a situation. We have all these desires we plan. We want them to be fulfilled. Some of them are not being fulfilled, so we're hoping against hope that they will be fulfilled in due course of time. But then the time factor is destroying everything. So when the living entity sees that he becomes, Prabhupada says that he becomes sad. Just imagine, suppose you planted your seed in a field that is suffering from, that place where you planted the seed is suffering from excessive rain, excessive heat, drought comes, and then after that's gone, the insect plague comes and devours everything. After that passes, so many animals come and devour everything. Will you expect that that seed is going to have any hope of survival? Probably not. So that's what's happening in the material world. We planted all these seeds in our various fields of activities, which expands to the whole material world, beginning with I am God and the whole material world is mine. And then all these activities, trees, seeds of desire are being killed by the excessive rains and insect plague of the time factor. So because the jiva is thinking that this field of activity is the source of his happiness, that's how we are defining field of activity means a source of happiness. So naturally, if your source of happiness is being devastated, then you're going to become sad. This phenomenon we can see happen all the time in terms of people's cars. Sometimes when their cars get hit, they become sad. Because the cars are their field of activity. Literally, like their field of activity, and they're going to use it to drive all over their other fields of activity in the material world. Just like one of my friends, his car got smashed on the side, and he has a very expensive car. And it got smashed from the side, so that, you know, and the person who smashed him said that it was his fault, even though the guy was drunk and he smashed him to the side. Anyway, so he was so devastated. I wouldn't say devastated, but he was just like frustrated. So this is the nature of the material world. The Chaitra God thinking that the Chaitra is his source of happiness and is being devastated by time, he becomes more and more despondent. So the word used here is abhimani. This sadness is a result of too much absorption in the field of activity and their and those particular seeds that have sprouted up, like family, society, friendship, love. These are the very seeds that sprouted up. So due to abhimani, too much absorption in that, then he becomes sad. It's like a person, like for devotees, usually we're driving these beat down cars. So if it gets hit, it's like, oh, okay, Jitendra will fix it, you know, like that. Where usually, I'm not saying that's a good thing, I'm just saying that's usually what happens. We drive like the Toyota Corolla, and I'll speak personally. We have one other Toyota car, it was a red car. I used to drive it most of the time. And right before I went to India, like a week before I went to India, I got into a huge car accident, and the whole car was totaled. And then I said, anyway, it was old. We were very, Jitendra, of course, was very fried. He was very fried but with me that time. But I was very, like, detached because I said, anyway, it was, anyway, useless thing. Why we should be so attached after all, we're devotees, et cetera, like that we were mentioning. So only, so in other words, I wasn't absorbed in the car. I didn't identify with it so much. It wasn't mine. And therefore, when it got totaled, this was not a very responsible mentality, but I'm making a principle here. Try to understand the principle. I'm not promoting, you know, irresponsible behavior. It was irresponsible. It was my third year or fourth year in Krishna consciousness. So anyway, it was irresponsible behavior, but try to see the principle. The principle is I wasn't attached to it as mine, and therefore I'll be detached. So in the same way, this abhimani is being used is due to too much absorption. And the language of the Bhagavatam is dvitiya. Dvitiya means seeing something separate from Krishna. Bhayam dvitiya binivesha tashat. Ishara petasha viparyayo ashmitihi. Tamaya yato. What is that? Tamaya yo tan abuddha. I forget the Sanskrit. Tamaya yato buddha abhajatam. Buddha abhajatam. Bhaktai kayesham guru deva tatma. This is a very important verse of the Bhagavatam. So it mentions the whole situation, why this absorption takes place. So it is described there by the Navayogindras that it begins with Ishade Petasha. It begins when we turn our back on Krishna. Of course, that can refer to the original, let's say, fall down from the spiritual world, but it also refers to when we're doing every day, throughout the day, we may have periods where we're turning our back on Krishna. So we shouldn't think of this turning our back on Krishna just as the original fall down. But constantly, this tendency to turn the back on Krishna is there in the jiva because he's very minute. So what happens when he turns his back on Krishna? Then it mentioned two effects of turning the back on Krishna. Viparyayo. Viparyayo means one's conception of life becomes reversed. So instead of thinking I'm a spirit soul, I think that I'm a product of matter. That is the first effect of turning the back on Krishna. And the second effect is ashmitihi, tat. Ashmitihi means forgetfulness. Of that, tat means that, forgetfulness of that Lord, forgetfulness of the beauty of Krishna, forgetfulness of the beauty of Krishna's names, his forms, his qualities, his activities. So due to forgetting Krishna and not seeing Krishna present in the material world, we think the material world is separate from Krishna. So we become absorbed in that which is separate from Krishna. We become absorbed in the phantasmagorical name, forms, qualities, and activities of this material world. And so as we get more and more absorbed in those things, then the whole idea of self-realization doesn't even occur to us. It doesn't even occur. It's not like it's just like when you're in a movie, or maybe a more pertinent example for men is video games. When we first got our first Sega Genesis, I don't know if any of you remember Sega Genesis, we had Segas. I remember when we first got the first Sega Genesis, you forgot about eating. Samadhi. It was like literally you'd be playing. Easily 12 hours was no problem to do 12 hours video games, like very easy. And the mother would call you for eating, don't disturb, I'm on level 5, you know. This is my first time eating the level 5. And we'd be so absorbed. And even if we were forced to go and eat, we would eat like, scarf it down and then run back to the video. I mean, I'm sure many of us have this experience when we first got video games. And so we're so absorbed, it didn't even occur to us that we should eat. Like something that's very important for us didn't even occur to our minds. And actually, this apparently is a phenomenon, especially in Asian countries, where I saw some news articles a long time back where a person played a video game for 3 days straight. Can you imagine? 3 days straight without eating, sleeping, nothing. 3 days straight. And after he finished, he got up and died. I'm sorry, that's not nice to laugh like that. I mean, I'm not laughing at the Jeeva situation. I'm laughing at the absurdity of it. It's very absurd. Like, if you were to hear about that normally, you wouldn't even believe it was true. But it's because it's so absurd. It's so absurd that a person can be so absorbed in video games for 3 days that he would just get up and die. Because he didn't eat, he didn't sleep, nothing. So the body couldn't handle the pressure, he got up and died. And apparently this is a phenomenon that happens particularly in Asian countries. It happened to a young man in America about a year ago, so that's how it got in the news. And then they had links for Asian countries where this is quite a popular phenomenon. So it can, in other words, I'm explaining the principle. It is possible to become so absorbed in something that it doesn't even occur to you that something is very important for your existence. So in the same way, having turned our back on Krishna, we've become so absorbed in the name, forms, qualities, and activities of this material world that it doesn't even occur to us the importance of God consciousness. And even when we start trying to think about how it may be important, then Maya attacks us in another way, indicated in this verse by Mayaya. How does Maya attack us in another way? By creating various conceptions of life in the modes of material nature. That makes us think that everything is relative. This is what is discussed in the purport. Maya, the modes of nature combine within the mind as a myriad of conceptions of life. So that when that myriad of conceptions of life enter into the mind, then we start to think that everything is relative. So then we also start to think that worship of God, etc., is just another relative truth. Why are we having such a hard time preaching? Because people in the modern education system, you know, so-called very learned persons, they're hearing so many opinions and so many contradictory ideas that they think our presentation is just one of such many ideas. So it's very hard to convince them. It's like, you know, so in Christianity alone, there's over 2,000 denominations of Christianity. And they probably all hate each other. And then within Christian consciousness is popping up, and in Muslim tradition it pops up. So you have just a variety of religions itself creates a confusion. And then on top of that, you got New Age. You know, and you go to the bookstore and you have the whole New Age shelf, or shelves that stretch for a period. And which book do you read? You want to be a spiritual person. Which book do you go for? And then on top of that, you have things like all these scientific journals, and books which speak all types of foolish things. So in this way, people have to, especially in school, they make you study all these things. I used to always wonder, if I'm majoring for, let's say, home economics, what do I need with a calculus degree? It's home economics. But even if a person's going for a major of home economics, they make you take biology, they make you take philosophy. Philosophy, this is the real dangerous one. And in philosophy class, you get to learn philosophies like existentialism and absurdism. It was a new one I heard of. You know, in this philosophy of absurdism, the conclusion of this philosophy is the only question you have to ask yourself is, should I kill myself or not? That's the conclusion of this absurdism philosophy. One student just told me, I didn't know this. Same with existentialism. You have these existentialists, many of them committed suicide. Nietzsche, I think he ended up in an insane asylum. I used to ask the students, if these philosophies couldn't help them, how are they going to help me? Why would I have to study these foolish things? No, but you're forced to say, if you want to graduate with honors and get on the dean's list and get a good job, you better learn to take all these classes. So then what happens, you hear all these various opinions. And not only are you hearing them, but you have to absorb yourself in them if you want to pass a test. And then what happens is a God-conscious devotee comes along and he starts speaking about Krishna, and we start to think, that's just one of the many ideas that I've heard. So many ideas I've heard before, and this is just one amongst them. So in this way, Maya keeps us bound up and absorbed, and so absorbed that we don't even realize the importance of worshiping Krishna. So then the Bhagavatam says, so as a result of this, bhayam, the living entity is always absorbed in fear. He's always fearful. In other words, to make To be spiritual, to make spiritual advancement, means to become fearless. We may be thinking that I've chanted so many rounds, I'm chanting 64 rounds every day, I'm absorbing the Bhagavatam, etc. And sometimes we ask this question, how can I know if I'm making spiritual advancement? One way indication, I'm speaking in this way in context of the verse that I'm quoting, is how much are you becoming freed from fear? Like, suppose you have a nice big house, if the government takes it, are we going to be afraid of that? Anyway, I'm not speaking in terms of, you know, we have our duties and so on. Try to understand the simple, basic point that I'm making. Is that this is a good indication of how much I'm becoming spiritually matured. The first quality Krishna mentions in the Divine and Demoniac chapter of divine life is abhayam, fearlessness. When Srila Prabhupada took initiation from Bhaktisiddhanta told him, you already have a spiritual name, abhaya. Abhaya meaning fearless. So this is that, spiritual life means fearlessness, and lack of spiritual life, lack of connection to Krishna, means full of fear. So if we want to get out of this situation, if we are intelligent, Buddha abhijetam. Buddha means intelligent. If we are intelligent, then abhijetam, then we should fully, with full devotion. Abhijet means with full devotion. Full devotion means not taking Krishna as a relative truth. Even as devotees, the tendency will be to accept Krishna as a relative truth. Means that we want to adjust our Krishna conscious programs relative to our situation in the material world, right? So this, sometimes you hear devotees often make the point, I don't have time for studying. I don't have time for hearing. I don't have time for chanting my rounds, you know, properly, etc. That means the tendency is to accept Krishna as a relative truth. Relative to my situation, then I'll worship Krishna. So that won't free us from fear. So if we want to become free from fear, if we are intelligent, we want to free ourselves from this negative absorption, then Buddha abhijetam, we must fully worship Krishna. That means accepting Krishna as an absolute truth. That means accepting Krishna is absolutely there in every time and in every space. So that means even if a person is going to his work, he can begin to understand that Krishna is also there. And his purpose for being there is to worship Krishna. So in that way, Bhaktya Eka means with pure devotion he's worshiping Krishna, Guru Deva Tatma, accepting the Guru as a non-different manifestation of Krishna and understanding that by adherence to the order of Guru, to his instructions, then one can shift his absorption. Without shifting our abhimani, we're expanding on the word abhimani, without shifting our absorption, then we become overwhelmed by the a devastation that takes place through the field of activities where we've planted so many desires. And it becomes very painful. Therefore, Lord Brahma says in his prayers to Krishna, what is that? He says, for those who are not your devotees, Yavat Krishna Natejana, for those persons who are not devotees of you, my dear Lord, then their attachments and desires remain thieves. Their homes remain prisons, and their affection for family remains foot shackles. The Lord Brahma's prays like this is a very cool and interesting prayer. So this is what's happening to Paranjana, because he's so absorbed. Mamata Akula Prabhupada is translated as affection for family, an attachment and affection for family. So this is what's happening to Paranjana. He's so absorbed in his field of activities in the form of attachment to friendship and family, etc., that this affection has become a foot shackle. So he's going to remain in the bondage of samsara. So then the Bhagavatam is trying to give warning to us that we should shift our absorption, Guru Deva Tatma, by following the process of Krishna consciousness under the able guidance of a bona fide guru. And then by doing so, we can become freed from fear and we can go back home, back to Godhead. So these are some points, simple points we can make here. Are there any comments? Anyone wants to say anything extra? Or ask anything? No? Okay, yeah.
Purifying some of the fields of desire from your body. So if one has a different fruit of, you said unlimited fruit of desires that keep coming up, a myriad of different seeds, is it best just to keep ignoring them, Or is it, I mean, I'm supposing it's individual, but could you talk about that practically?
There's a verse in the Bhagavatam to mention, Akama Sarva Kamova Moksha Kama Udaridihi Tivrena Bhakta Yogena Yajeta Purusham Param. So it mentions whether one is desireless, like a devotee, or he's full of desires, or he has desires for liberation. If he is Udharadi, Udharadi means he has a broad intelligence, broad-minded person, then he will worship Krishna only. So many times people think this verse means that if I have material desires, let me worship Krishna, and then Krishna will fulfill my material. I'll worship Krishna for fulfilling my material desires. But Srila Prabhupada clearly says in that purport, no, that whatever it is, whether you're full of desires or no desires or desire for liberation, in any case, you should worship Krishna fully. That means only worship Krishna. And then Krishna, you know, will fulfill desire accordingly, according to his own, you know, let's say, kindness or, his own, how you say, desire. According to his own desire, he will fulfill the desire. But Prabhupada says there that whether we are full of desires, it is not that we should worship Krishna to fulfill those desires, nor should we try to pursue material desires on our own. That is just sheer foolishness. Rather, we should fully worship Krishna. And then Krishna, the way Krishna consciousness works is that he fulfills all those desires in a very unique way. Just like if you have, Prabhupada would say, if you have $1,000,000, then all your $10 problems are solved, right? And there's something else that's interesting about this analogy. When you have $10 million, you have $10 million desires. Your $10 desires go away, right? This is a unique thing about having more and more money. So in the same way, the way Krishna fulfills all our desires is by giving us $10 million in the form of his own association, in the form of experience of the happiness of Krishna consciousness. So when one gains that experience, then he gets the fruit of all the desires. What is the fruit of all the other desires? He wants to be happy. So by getting that experience, then all his $10 desires go away, because now he has this big, big desire to please Krishna. So we need not give attention to material desires in terms of absorbing ourselves in that, folks. You know, just like Prabhupada has given another analogy that is interesting, that when you have ink is a very dense substance. And if you try to clean a cup of ink, it is very difficult to do so. But Krishna said, Prabhupada gives this analogy that if you put a more dense substance in it, then the ink will go away, and everything gets purified. So the more dense substance than ink, Prabhupada mentions, is milk. So you pour in the milk, and then all the ink goes away. So our process, we always hear this about Krishna consciousness, that Krishna consciousness is the positive alternative. We hear this a lot, isn't it? Krishna consciousness is the positive alternative. Prabhupada says yoga means plus, right? Yoga means plus. He says this in the Journey of Self-Discovery. That's interesting. Yoga means plus. So our idea is to become plus Krishna, or add the denser substance of Krishna consciousness. Then the inky desires will go away. So, and that is the positive alternative. So it's like if you try to clean an inky substance with inky substance, then that is sheer foolishness. So in the same way to try to fulfill material desires is ridiculous. It'll never be successful. Our desires will never go away. But instead of giving so much attention to those desires, they're there, you can acknowledge them, but we should spend more of our energy in the positive cultivation. And then in that way, the inky desires will be dissipated. Of course, it is not that we shouldn't take note of certain anarthas that may be especially victimizing us in our present sadak, you know, deha, our present life. There may be certain anarthas that are particularly we're being implicated by, and that way we should bring those things to the sadhus, and in their association have those things surmounted. But then the rest of the time is a positive cultivation. So it's not like, just like Srila Prabhupada is also told, like, this is interesting, when many times when we're cooking, the tendency may be to be don't lust over the food, don't lust, don't lust, don't lust. Oh, but then you've defeated in your purpose. Prabhupada said, rather we should think about how Krishna will enjoy this preparation. And that's a positive cultivation. Rather, if we cultivate the mentality, how will Krishna enjoy this preparation? Instead of thinking, oh, don't lust, oh, that smells good. No, don't say that. You know, that, then we're defeated in our endeavor to please Krishna. But if we're thinking, how will Krishna enjoy this preparation? That is the positive cultivation. So we spend more of our energy in the positive cultivation. And then the negative desires, etc., will subside. That's my Hare Krishna. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you were thinking it's not yours. But if you were thinking it's Krishna's, then the responsibility is not there. And that not mine, not mine, not mine is an impersonal philosophy. It's always the positive that we have to reinforce.
Mm-hmm. That's a nice point. You got that? Were you able to hear? Yeah, she was saying, this is a very good point. That if we are always thinking, in the car example that I gave, I was thinking not mine, therefore I was detached from it. So you're saying this cultivation of not mine, not mine, not mine, not mine is a negative cultivation. Neti, neti. It's a neti, neti process. So the positive cultivation is to add Krishna. This is Krishna's property. I would have thought it in a different way because it belongs to Krishna. And it's a positive mentality of how to see the material world around us. It's a nice point. Okay. Does anyone else want to mention anything? No?
I was just having a thought on the question of proprietorship, how that manifests in the spiritual world. Like, for instance, in Krishna's pastimes, if all the devotees there, so much paraphernalia, they're fully aware that everything is belonging to Krishna, or how does the sense of proprietorship operate in the liberated or the perfected path? Because here we have to be trained to see that way, but it may seem like in the spiritual world maybe there's different so-called possessions or something. Maybe that's just the influence of yoga maya. Just on the topic of proprietorship,
in simple
free
language, the way I understand it is that one of the features of prema is mentioned in Nectar Devotion is this deep sense of possessiveness of Krishna. So that means Krishna is mine. Just like they have this saying that possession turns sand into gold. You've heard this? Is this the saying? Possession turns sand into gold. As same analogy. When I say this is not mine, then I'm very detached. But as soon as I think it is mine, then the type of care that I take for it transforms. Just like you think this body is mine. So the type of care you show for the body is very strong. In the same way, when one is thinking, Krishna is mine, this is one of the features of prema bhakti mentioned in Act of Devotion, in the part that we're allowed to read, is that Krishna is mine. So if Krishna is mine, this is a feature of love. So how you will be relating to Krishna. And then the way you see other things is in connection to that relationship. So Srila Prabhupada is told, just like when a mother sees the shoes of her child, she loves the child. She loves the shoes. She may even deal with the shoes very affectionately, and she may even start to cry and all these things, remembering her cute kid when he was two. Now he's a demon. So she may cry seeing the shoes, because Prabhupada says it's not that she's loving the shoes exactly. She loves her child, and so because she sees a child in those shoes, so then she loves the shoes. So the way that possessiveness of Krishna works is that I love Krishna, I think he is mine. And then I see Krishna in everything as a result of my attachment to Krishna in that way. The more, the stronger the feeling of possession, the stronger the consciousness gets absorbed. Just like I remember when I was a kid, and not a kid, I was a little bit older, high school, and my younger cousin would come over. He was like a young boy, maybe like 5 or 6. And whenever he would walk into our room visiting us, whatever we would touch, he would grab and say, mine. And we'd be like, what? And then we would say, okay, you can play with that. And then I would go and play with something else. And then he would walk over and say, mine. I'm like, dang. And then I would go, okay, you play with that. I would go sit at my chessboard, and I would pick up a rook, and he would grab the rook and say, mine. I was like, well, they start young, huh? That demoniac cultivation. So the stronger the feeling of mine, the stronger the absorption, the consciousness. So when one has pure love of God, then they're thinking Krishna is theirs and whatever particular relationship with Krishna. And then they're seeing everything in context of that relationship. So they see Krishna in everything because the relationship of everything to Krishna, they see Krishna in everything. As a mother sees her child in the shoes, so the Premika devotee sees Krishna in everything. The analogy that is given in the Bhagavatam is very sweet in this regard. Just like if I love you, then you have so many clothes on, but I love the person, not the clothes. So I'm interested in the person and not his external dress. So in the same way, Krishna is in everything. So although it may look like a devotee is relating to the material world, he's actually seeing Krishna in that. And this whole material existence is like a cloth covering Krishna, but the devotee actually sees Krishna. So he relates to everything in a very sacred manner. So that is a very simple understanding of the perfectional concept of the sense of mindness. Krishna is mine. Like that.
Another question. It's a little off topic. A little. Really. You mentioned the perfectional stage, how it manifests in possessive, in the nature of possessiveness. Another thing that I was reading is how it the nature of humility automatically manifests along with prema. So I was wondering, how do we understand this the humility of like great personalities? That's obviously arising with their devotional sentiments.
Well, how does a blind man understand the sun? Very difficult, right? We have this analogy of five blind men trying to understand what is an elephant. And then the man who can see is looking at the ridiculous situation. And they're all saying, one is feeling the triangle, oh, an elephant is a snake. It's probably a pretty big snake, anaconda or something. And one's grabbing his leg and thinking, oh, the elephant is a pillar. Someone's holding the body of the elephant. Oh, it's a wall. So then they all are wrong. And if they all come together, then they become more confused. This is called modern science. They're all groping in the dark, and then they come together and share their theories with one another, and then they confuse the whole situation even more. So a blind man cannot understand the qualities of a devotee. When we're spiritually blind, spiritually unadvanced, we cannot understand the spiritual position of a devotee. Even what we'll be appreciating from them, oftentimes in our immaturity, will be an appreciation of something of the modes of nature. Not that they're in the modes of nature, but according to our modes of nature, we're getting some appreciation. I always joke, so that if you're a rock star and you see a kirtan devotee's like, then you may relate that vision to your impressions of rock star life. So you may think, that is my guru. You know, you may become inspired in that particular way. Having a material concept of the spiritual master like that and then wanting to establish a relationship based on that misconception. So, in other words, these qualities of a devotee cannot be understood without coming to an advanced stage, actually, a liberated stage. Srila Prabhupada said it takes one to know one in NOI 6. Just like, for example, I'll give a really interesting example. When Arjuna wants to kill 6 million people, that was out of humility. And it's his not wanting to do so is due to pride. Because pride means rejection of the order of Krishna. And humility means submission to the order of Krishna in simple terms. That is humility. So many times people think that Arjuna was good. He was doing really good in the first chapter. And then due to this Krishna, you know, he became bad. In fact, a lot of spiritual, so-called spiritual authorities, they even say like that. Gandhi, I think he was noted for saying that if my Krishna is a violent Krishna, then I reject Krishna. I reject Bhagavad Gita. So I guess that's what you did. Then. So in other words, his point was that Krishna is not violent. So this whole scene on the battlefield is just an allegory. That's what something like that. So obviously we don't appreciate that misconstruing of the truth. So humility, so how do you understand that as a humble action? And now, especially nowadays, you have this terrorism going on, and people are doing this suicide bombing and all these things. So now when people read the Bhagavad Gita and they see that, they're relating what they're experiencing in the material world to that scene in Bhagavad Gita. So they don't think it's humility. They think it's demoniac life going on. So without, in other words, without coming to a spiritual platform, just like if I'm standing on the second floor, I can't understand what's going on the fourth floor. I have to go to the fourth floor to understand what's going on the fourth floor. So in the same way, without coming to the spiritual platform, we can't truly understand and truly gain a profound appreciation for their spiritual qualities. So we've often heard that such spiritual personalities will relate to us in a way that will engender a certain amount of appreciation so that we can begin the process of devotional service. But then we should understand that that we're not having perfect vision of the devotees. Therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he also prays in one of his prayers, when will that day be mine when I'll be able to see the Vaishnavas properly so that I can chant the holy names of Krishna properly? When will I gain that respect for the Vaishnavas? So Bhaktivinoda Thakur is trying to help us gain insight that it's not such an easy task to really see devotees properly. And he's making the point that by that proper vision of devotees, we'll be able to actually chant the holy name properly. Or say it in the other way, without that vision, we're not going to be able to chant properly. So that means if we want to gain that spiritual vision, we have to advance. That's what I'm making the point. Without actually maturing, then it will be very hard to gain a very profound appreciation. We'll appreciate the qualities of goodness, but then when a devotee does something that appears to be passionate, he may be transcendental, but it appears to be passionate, then we won't appreciate. Just like, for example, Srila Prabhupada Maharaj is very gentle, you know, beautiful sadhu, and he speaks very softly usually and very like this. One time at Northwestern University, someone was asking him, if you're a sannyasi, why do you have computers and you're using a PowerPoint? And he was kind of challenging Maharaj in this way. So Maharaj very nicely gave an answer of yuta vairagya. You know, he gave a like that and explained it to him. So the guy didn't understand, so he raised his hand again. And he said, just like Gandhi, we see that he lived by what he was speaking. So, and then like that, so it was a poke at Maharaj. And Maharaj, he hit his hand on the table, and the whole room was like, you saw all the sound came out of the ether, you know? And Maharaj, I just explained to you. In a very grave, very sober, it's still very peaceful. Maharaj's countenance didn't change, but the gravity of his voice changed. And then everyone was just like this. And then Maharaj said, you've understood now? I remember being in the class and I was like, yes. Because I always had that spirit, you know, like fighting. So when Maharaj, I was like, and then I talked to this person afterwards. I knew him from before, so I talked to him afterwards. And I don't think he really got it, but at that moment, you better have got it. At that time, it was like most essential. So they may think that someone would misconstrue. Oh, sadhu is supposed to be very peaceful. He shouldn't speak such heavy things. It should be very light, because they can't appreciate the real spiritual qualities. So I'm speaking about a neophyte devotee. So they'll be used to the way that a particular devotee is relating to them, very gentle and so on. And another devotee may become very heavy with them. And he may be equally transcendental, but we won't be able to understand that. So my point is that just as I'm not able to appreciate perhaps that heaviness coming from guru, that means I wasn't really appreciating the gentleness either. It was just a whole misconstrued idea. So then we have to actually mature and come to the spiritual platform of life. Okay, you can last comment.
Hare Krishna. This is on the same point. Just a couple of things came to mind. I was appreciating that without coming to the platform, we won't have any real understanding of spiritual humility. I asked a similar question and was told that, like, for example, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Lord himself, when he took the position of the devotee, he still had this humble mood. And it was explained to me that this is because he was thinking himself smaller than 1/10,000th the size of the tip of a hair. And then in the Lilamrita, just the other day, I was reading that Prabhupada was walking on this gravel road with his disciples, and he pointed at the stones and said, as many stones as there are as many universes. And in each universe, there are countless living entities. So these are two things that at least help me have like a superficial idea of.
Yeah, I wanted to point out that could be very superficial because let's take Mahaprabhu. And one of his Srivas Anga pastimes, one milk drinking brahmachari sneaks in to see the ecstasies Lord Chaitanya. So he's peeking through the closet, you know. And Lord Chaitanya is having like a most ecstatic kirtan, you know, and dancing. And suddenly Mahaprabhu says, "I am not feeling any ecstasy. Who's here in this room that's not supposed to be here?" So all the devotees start freaking out. You know, Srivas knows. He doesn't want to say anything at first. Finally, the milk drinking brahmachari comes out. And Mahaprabhu starts going crazy, you know, just chastising him. And he said, "Get out! Get out before I cut you into pieces." That's what it says in the Chaitanya Bhagavad. "Get out before I cut you into..." That doesn't seem like a very humble statement, superficially. "Get out before I cut you into pieces." Like, whoa. Well, I mean, when I first read that, you know, due to the material concept of life, I thought Mahaprabhu was supposed to be humble. No, he's making such a big deal because a milk-drinking brahmachari snuck in. Is that really that big of a deal? Or when he comes to kill Jagai Madai, you know, it seems like his sadhu is supposed to be peaceful. So that being 1/10,000th the tip of the hair is the humility of a devotee, but that's still how it manifests is very inconceivable for those who are on the material platform. Very inconceivable. Similarly, Srila Prabhupada, you may see Prabhupada is having that humility, but in this one morning walk, which we've shared many times, he's criticizing all these persons, Ramakrishna, etc. And then one Bengali man is walking with him. He says, "Srila Prabhupada, you are criticizing so many good men. Swamiji, so many good men you are criticizing." And Prabhupada said, "What good men? What good men?" I heard the lecture. You know, Jai Kesh will play it for you. He listens to it too every morning in my airport, he says. "What good men? Bring them here. I'll kick on their face. I'm so strong." What? So, who can appreciate that particular aspect of Srila Prabhupada? Now, I don't know if I'm not supposed to say that in a public forum. We don't want people to get misconceptions, you know, like that. But to be real, the point is that if we're not on a spiritual platform, we're not going to be able to understand. Even what we're appreciating is usually very artificial. And therefore, when a devotee seems to change his temperament toward us, then we don't appreciate. That means our appreciation was also of the same nature, false. So therefore, that will go on at the stage of Anishita Bhakti. We are oftentimes one of the categories of anarthas, which Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions, is this duplicity is there. It's very strong. We're not forthcoming. We're not very straightforward. So that's going to be there. We're always pretending, smiling in each other's faces, etc. But then a lot of other things will be going on in the heart. We're not simple. Saralata is the first quality of a real Vaishnava, simplicity. It means very straightforward. So we're not there yet. It takes spiritual advancement to be there. So we have to just understand that we need to mature. And the superlative importance of trying to avoid Vaishnava aparad in our speech, in our behavior, and in our mind, especially in the mind, knowing that I am not seeing the Vaishnavas properly. We must just understand the gravity of just until we can mature to a more advanced stage of Krishna consciousness, Madhyama platform. So I'm going to end there. I'm sorry for taking 5 minutes over. Thank you very much for tolerating me. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.